Hey, serious privacy enthusiasts. Ready to ace your AI data privacy game?
Oh, you bet, Kay. Dive into the world of TrustArc's Nemity Research, your go-to for staying on top of regulatory developments in AI and privacy.
Seriously, Nemity Research maintains a massive privacy and regulatory database featuring expert guidance and analysis from legal and privacy pros.
So save time on privacy research, cut your compliance timeline, and reduce costs with Nemity Research.
Get your regulatory research and insights at your fingertips with a free trial.
So get ahead in privacy compliance and start that free trial today. Go to trustarc.com/nimity-free-trial.
You're listening to Serious Privacy by TrustArc. Please welcome our hosts, Paul Breitbarth and Kay Royal.
It almost seems unreal after the last couple of months, but here in Europe, life is sort of starting to get back to normal. And come July, that means summer vacation for a lot of people. Borders are reopening, but with COVID apps aplenty, once every step is followed by the powers that be. And indeed, also I have replaced the peas of my kitchen table with even more peas on a mountain in France. In today's episode, Kay therefore has a free rein, and she has decided to do an open mic recording with privacy peeps from all over. I'm as curious as you are to hear what she is talking about. That said, my name is still Paul Breitbart.
And I'm Kay Royal, and welcome to Serious Privacy. Let's see how this went.
This is an experiment on Serious Privacy to have multiple people here with absolutely no scripting whatsoever as to what we're going to talk about. I am joined today by my co-host, Ralph O'Brien, out of the United Kingdom, which he has absolutely no idea what I'm going to ask him to do as co-host, but I haven't planned out what this is going to look like either. But if all of my guests could give a big hello to our super fan, everyone say, hi, Sophie.
Hi, Sophie.
Hi, Sophie.
I'm waving at the Zoom screen, which is weird.
We're going to do the unexpected question. And you can introduce your name and your company, whatever you would like to say who you are before you give your answer. But I'm going to limit your answer to literally one word. Okay? Y'all ready?
Ready.
Ready.
And I'll call out who to start with. So if you want to say your name and who you're with, you can. If you want to be completely anonymous, you can. What was your favorite grade before college? So Alexander, we're going to you first.
Alexander Hanf from Think Privacy, my favorite grade before college.
Number. I'm looking for a number, not an A or a B.
Oh, we don't do numbers in English.
Oh, what do you do?
We do A's, B's, C's.
What you mean you need?
Well, I meant like first grade, third grade, senior year of high school.
I went to boarding school, so they're all pretty bad. I don't know the equivalent of the US grade, but certainly the age of 15, 16 in high school for me. I don't know what that equates to in the US.
Probably about the same, 10th or 11th. Awesome. Okay, Ralph.
My favorite grade, I was probably still in what we call primary school. So that would be year 6. And that was when I learned to speak.
Oh.
I extremely had a terrible stutter when I was growing up. So the ability to stand up in front of people and talk is a unique privilege I've worked very, very hard for.
That is awesome. I've never had a problem talking.
Me either. My wife says I've got the best job in the world because I talk for a living and I never shut the hell up.
But I can appreciate that, Ralph, because I'll go into a short story of the reason I do public speaking is because in high school, I had an absolutely traumatic public speaking experience. And so since then, I focused on making sure I'm a good public speaker, but I still have nightmares about that up until about 2 years ago. People dream about walking naked through the city streets. I would wake up with nightmares about that public speaking experience. So I completely understand. Okay, so we are down to the next one on the list, although my order is changing. Dan, are you anonymous or not?
No, that's fine. You can.
Okay.
Not now.
Okay, D, are you anonymous?
No, you can use my name. I would say definitely senior year of high school. Loved that year.
Because it was the end?
It was the end, but also I got really involved in a number of different things, and I think that kind of made it a special year.
Awesome. Okay, so Bob.
Yeah, I'm going to go 11th. Same thing, yeah. So.
Because?
same thing, involved in a lot of stuff, and was really fulfilled and had a lot of fun.
I love it. Tom?
Yeah, I'll agree. Senior year in high school, that was the best because you're ready to get out. You have a sense of invincibility and power. We were allowed to drive our cars to school, and that was a big plus. So a lot of fun things happening in high school till adulthood kicked in the next year at college.
And our last one.
10th grade.
10th grade for pretty much the same reasons as the others?
Yeah, I was involved in a bunch of stuff in 10th grade.
I love it. So Alexander, it sounds like maybe your experiences in the UK are very similar to what they are here.
I dare say to some respects, yeah. I mean, we weren't allowed to drive cars into high school.
Oh, no.
Because we weren't allowed to get our driver's license until we were 17 at the earliest. So,
ooh.
Yeah. But it was really about the independence.
Right.
When I was 15, 16, I started to get a lot more independence, financial independence through part-time jobs and, you know, having a bike and my own computer for the first time. And so it was really about the independence more than anything else.
Wow. See, I'm the weirdo. I liked first grade. Yeah. Okay. So
I don't remember first grade. That was a long time ago.
Well, I only got in trouble twice in school and they were both a mistake and we'll just pretend those didn't happen. All right. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to put us on a very strict timing system. And I'm going to hold up a timer as we go, because I think that's the only way that we'll be able to make sure that we manage all the speakers. I know absolutely we're going to blow the timers, by the way. I know no one's going to stick to a time. So here we go. And let me go to a stopwatch or a timer. And I'm going to probably set it for 2 minutes. I want to go in basically the same realm, or y'all can just whoever wants to speak up, just say so. But tell me, what is the hot topic in privacy on your mind? And then when we hear all the topics, we can start, or maybe after one topic, I might ask a few others if they want to respond with like a minute. So 2 minutes to explain your hot topic, and then responders will get 1 minute each. Are we good?
We're good.
Okay. Then we're going to start with my co-host, since I didn't coordinate this with him, and say, Ralph, what is the hot topic on your mind?
Well, the hot topic on my mind at the moment is the same as it always is, and the same as it's been for the last 20 years. And that's essentially to help organizations to understand legal basis, I think, especially from a European perspective, you know, very different from the US perspective, you know, where instead of processing data, unless the law says you can't, you know, over in the EU, we're still with that mindset of the fundamental human rights approach of only being able to process data when the law says you can. And so understanding some of those fundamental misunderstandings around legal basis is a continued fight. But moving forwards, I'd say the biggest hot topic that I'm really enjoying getting involved in at the moment is privacy by design and making sure that organizations, you know, privacy being a Pandora's box, and, you know, once it's opened, you know, it can't be closed again. That means to me that privacy by design and getting it right first time, you know, is really important when helping my clients, my customers and technology vendors out there, making sure that the technology gets it right first time in order to safeguard people's data. I'm going to perhaps pitch over to in a slightly different order here, because I know that Alex especially has been working with a number of organizations on very similar privacy by design initiatives. So, Alex, I think I'll probably come to you next and kind of say, you know, what is the hot topic for you with the companies you've been working with?
Oh, there's so many at the moment. The world's in chaos currently. So to choose one hot topic is really difficult. We've got the German presidency now. So the e-privacy file has been reopened. And hopefully we'll go to trialogue. That's obviously something very close to my heart. I've been working on that as an advisor to the European Parliament for the last 3 years or so, and obviously worked on the Privacy Directive and GDPR before that. So that's something which is really up on my radar at the moment. Privacy by design, obviously, as you state, is something that I've been working on again for over 10 years as an ambassador and representative for the EU. So it's always, you know, I'm always looking to persuade companies to do the right thing when it comes to privacy by design. It's not always so easy. But then when we look at the current circumstances with COVID-19 and coronavirus pandemic, contact tracing really comes sharply into mind, not just how governments are contact tracing with regards to being able to detect the spread of the virus, but also as part of a task force with a big legal firm with regards to contact tracing within corporate environments, what liabilities do companies have if they don't have contact tracing and some of their staff get sick, what safeguards need to be in place, what sort of new technologies are emerging to help deal with contact tracing. So there's a vast swathe of things at the moment which keep me awake at night. And, you know, it's really difficult to choose any particular one, and I'm out of time.
Perfect. What he said, right. Well, what he said, Kay, I think, yeah.
So is anyone else have any thoughts on privacy by design, especially if you don't agree that's the way to go?
Now, the only thoughts I think that I would offer is I think the challenge is if you're dealing with legacy systems and supporting legacy data, the privacy by design becomes very, very difficult. And so part of that is working with the business and the IT to see, you're going to have to move to new technology. You're going to have to move to new ways to practically apply privacy by design, because if you try to, many of the situations we've been in, if you try to apply privacy by design principles into legacy systems, by that I mean, you know, applications and databases and workflows that were written 20 plus years ago, they break. So that doesn't help anyone. So anyway, that's where I think the biggest challenge is privacy is you're going to have to create migration strategies if you're going to look at privacy by design.
I like that. Okay, let's go to the next hot topic, and we can return to any of these after we get out the hot topic. So Dan, looks like you're next up. What is your hot topic?
Yeah, I agree with the cohorts. This is a really good question and a difficult one because there's so many to choose from. I would say for me that one of the biggest hot topic for me is probably data subject requests and a more specific area of data subject requests, not directly from the individual, but now you have new agents coming forward that are actually representing individuals like SayMine.com. I've received several of these from SayMine where a very bright agent company that's affiliated with a law firm can go out, collect people's information and actually data mine them at their request, and then handle as an agent their data subject requests in a slew of different areas. So I think that agency, I didn't expect it to come from a third party that wasn't a law firm, but now you've got them affiliated with law firms. And so it makes it a little more treacherous because you're not really dealing with the individual themselves. You're dealing with an agent that has the technology and sophistication to be able to really make some very strong data subject requests that have a lot of weight. I think that's one of the biggest issues for me.
Are you facilitating those requests? I deal with a lot of organizations that are making some really interesting choices with looking at the sort of requests that especially made in volume by third parties, especially how you authenticate they're actually from the individual, whether they indeed you even accept them at all. You know, subject access requests as a service has been mooted by some to be kind of against the spirit of the law in some cases. So I'm just really interested to hear organizations that are actually taking them and dealing with them as genuine requests, or whether you're going through a further layer of validation.
Yes, it's a great point. We've pushed back on a few of those, and I'm amazed at the aggressive behavior that these agents take on behalf of their clients. I agree with you that maybe outside the spirit of the law, it's not really increasing the acumen of an individual to exercise his or her data subject rights, for example, under Articles 14 through 22 of the GDPR. But rather now you have an agent that's promoting themselves and is driven by profit gaining motives to be able to either create a data subject request that then, you know, clears the data for their client and they get paid that way, or on the back end they get paid because you create a problem for them by trying to verify identity under Article 12, or you take further steps and say this isn't a valid request and then watch them, you know, take further aggressive steps, either legally or with respect to regulatory intervention in the complaint. It's just an interesting new world that I didn't expect would happen so aggressively and so soon.
Anyone else experiencing that?
I have a couple of points on this, actually. I think this was inevitable, first and foremost, particularly because it's very difficult to suggest that people shouldn't be able to contract agents to act on their behalf in legal matters. Because most people don't understand the law as individuals, maybe in layman's terms, but not with any expertise or specialization. So it's completely normal for people to hire agents in matters of legal capacity. So I think that should have been completely expected. But I've also seen similar situations. So in Denmark, there's a company, I believe, called We Are David, kind of David and Goliath playoff. And they've been very aggressive in sending out requests. And they're monetizing it by charging companies in order to be able to access their API to upload the data in order to furnish that request. So their monetization model is really very interesting and quite aggressive, to say the least. But the interesting thing for me from the supervisory authority perspective is they're fairly well supported by the Danish supervisory authority, who think that this should be something, who think this is something that data subjects should have the right to access, because it's really difficult to go through this process yourself if you don't understand anything to do with privacy and data protection as an individual.
Wow.
I totally agree with Alex that at the end of the day, you know, people should always be able to have agents who are more experts than they are to contract on their behalf. But what's fascinating about what Alex just said is the way supervisory bodies supporting vendors. We're seeing a number of cases across the world where, you know, supervisory bodies are now doing webinars with vendors, or they're, you know, taking training from vendors, or, and, you know, there becomes some interesting conflict of interest arguments at that point, I think.
I love it. I love it. Okay, to keep with our forum then, Tom, we're going to come to you. What's the hot topic on your mind?
Well, I'm going to back up to a much broader perspective of surveillance. And my ears perked up when I heard privacy by design, because I think that's in very inherent conflict with the what you might call surveillance by design.
Lack of privacy by design, right?
That's right. And listening to Paul Breitbart on your last episode, where he talked about surveillance being his hot topic, really struck a chord with me, because everything from biometrics to facial recognition, even to contact tracing, it all involves surveillance by design to accomplish a purpose, whether it's identity control or authentication or whatever. A lot of the tasks that we're doing with modern technologies are designed to surveil people. And that's not necessarily a bad term. Of course, it can be a bad term if it's a covert surveillance, but there's a lot of hot subjects right now in overt, open surveillance that are very important to our society. And so that really is one of my hot buttons that I like to focus on. And I think it's just a growing field when you start talking about Internet of Things and, you know, just different modern technologies that are coming in and really upsetting the apple cart of society. So I'm more interested in the policy issues of how our normative values change about surveillance as time marches forward with technology.
Oh, I love that, because one of the examples in the CCPA regs to me speaks to that a lot, because it talks about, for example, a flashlight app that tracks location, right? I think that would surprise anybody to read it, to go, why would my flashlight app be tracking location? Well, surveillance, hello.
Absolutely.
Any responses to that? Mr. Smith.
Just thinking out loud here, I was actually looking something up.
You knew I was coming to you for a hot topic next.
Yes. That's obviously a much revisited example of over collection is the flashlight with the location. And there are other examples like that. And we need to get out of that business and get more focused on collecting what we need instead of what we might someday be able to.
Yeah. Further reactions.
I think when it comes to surveillance by design, obviously surveillance is probably close to all of our heart. Anybody working in privacy at some point has had some voice in the debate over surveillance. I know certainly my roots in privacy stem from behavioral profiling and targeting, which is the ultimate form of commercial surveillance currently being monetized around the world. And it's something that still takes up huge amounts of my time as an advocate and as a lobbyist. And interestingly enough, I wrote an article for a law journal in France recently called Third, where I used the term surveillance by design for the first time when I was talking about IoT, things like the within scales and all these other smart devices that we use, which are sending massive amounts of data, health data and other types of data up to their own servers for their own purposes. I actually have a complaint with Canil against Withins currently, which has been ongoing for over a year now, relating to these issues with regards to GDPR compliance and the e-privacy directive compliance. And surveillance by design, I think, is a really interesting term that is quite scary, you know, because we tend to think that when we're using services, I won't name many specific companies, but when we're using services online or products online, which are usually free, we tend to think about the benefits that we gain from those services as opposed to the consequences. And one of those consequences, obviously, as we all know in this business, is this surveillance, this ubiquitous surveillance, which is happening everywhere. So I'd like to hear the phrase used a lot more, because I think it's a very useful way of making people think a bit more about the consequences of convenience.
I like that.
Yeah.
But I will have to say, anyone that's surveilling me, they're so bored off their butts. It's ridiculous. Okay. Well, in that case, so Mr. Smith, let's go to you. And what is your favorite or your hot topic of privacy right now?
A little bit one-off from privacy, but this fake news and the Twitter response to Trump's posts and free press versus platform responsibility, which does come back to privacy. I think that's really kind of a hot topic. And related to that, surveillance and intrusion related to COVID. We in the U.S. for a while had some debates about burqas and things like that and being able to wear a mask in public, and now we're required. That's kind of a weird change of position, and it's raised a bunch of interesting issues. Meanwhile, we've got additional surveillance because of COVID as well, and that's causing all kinds of conflict as well.
I love that. Mm-hmm. I think the fake news and the platform responsibility is probably one that I would say that's fascinating. That's absolutely fascinating with that, because when you mentioned mask, I started thinking about something we rarely think about nowadays that gives you actual privacy.
Yeah. It's very interesting. I mean, I started in privacy looking at the needs of the many compared to the needs of the few. Actually, I started on the other side, because I was in law enforcement. You know, I was a privacy professional for the police way back when. And that was actually, when I think about the late 90s and the fact that nothing was connected, and you know, people could move over a state boundary and disappear because the systems could talk to each other, or didn't talk to each other, more to the point, how far we've come. You know? And we've moved. I remember specifically a project I was working on, which was for a ring of steel around London after September the 11th, 2001, a ring of cameras around London, and they were developing a technology now known as ANPR, you know, ANPR. And they were so dangerous, this ANPR technology, that it was only allowed for one-off ring of steel for anti-terrorism purposes. The ring of steel is now the London congestion charge zone, and ANPR is now on every garage, petrol station, parking lot, multi-story car park that you could probably, you know, shake a stick at. And so you go from this sort of function creep of a technology that's, you know, being considered really, really dangerous 20 years ago to something that's, you know, almost ubiquitous now. And I think that's the danger with us sort of sleepwalking into the surveillance society, as Alex was quite talking about. And I think surveillance and the needs of the many compared to the needs of the few is always going to be questions we ask ourselves in this sort of balancing act that we have to precariously kind of walk on. Dan, I can see you kind of nodding away there. I mean, how does that balancing act, you know, of sort of the needs of the many compared to the needs of the few, and sort of manifest itself for you?
Yeah, I think I'd go back to what we just talked about in surveillance, because you've got me thinking about some things. The surveillance, you know, as I see people protesting today in different parts of the world, especially in our US context, versus contact tracing, for example, there's been a polarization of people saying, look, we need more contact tracing, we need more, maybe not surveillance, but recognition, biometrics, or other capabilities to be able to stay safer. And then you've got this kind of polarization going the other way, saying, well, we also have had some false positives in surveillance, so we need less facial recognition, we need less surveillance. Now I'm even hearing a third voice, which is, if we're going to defund police forces, we're going to need more automated surveillance. And as I think about, what you said, needs of many versus needs of the few, it's hard to run a popularity contest with this, because it's so polarized right now. And I'm not really sure. I see different state, local, and even federal governments deciding for themselves what their culture is in terms of this, what their appetite for it is. But again, you're getting a polarization based on politics, I think. And it's going to be very interesting to see how we come together in the appropriate use of surveillance to you know, address the needs of the many while still listening to the voices of perhaps the few.
Right. Okay. So I think we have... We can come back to it. That's okay. We can come back to it. But I want to make sure that we capture... I think I'm missing Bob and Alex's. So, Bob, did I miss your hot topic in privacy?
You did, but that's okay because I commented on privacy by design.
What's your hot topic? What came to your mind? When I said, let's try this, you know, my open mic concept, what do you go, ooh, I want to talk about?
I think I want to talk a little bit. I mean, I think the hot topic right now for me is cross-border data transfer still. Okay. I still think there's a tremendous amount of confusion that's out there still. Even in today's age, I still get questions about privacy shield applicability.
And wait till next week.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So yeah,
which
why
next
I it
week
timely.
we are doing an episode on the 16th. We're recording it, and we plan to release it the next day. Okay. So we're going to try to get y'all as much information as we can quickly.
I won't preempt that. So no, I think cross border data transfer, and I just think, you know, obviously Brexit adds to that for those of us, you know, and the saber rattling, I'll call it, coming out of the European Court of Justice. And the
beautiful
parliament about standard contractual clauses redo, you know, it just scares me a bit. That's what keeps me up at night, is that opening Pandora's box. And there's so many competing interests in there. So I think that's the hot topic I have, is just the data flow and how we properly certify, you know, under our contractual obligations and our regulatory obligations, how we move data between affiliates and between clients.
So we're doing an entire podcast next week on the results of the Schrems judgment, talking about international data transfers. So follow-up question, crystal ball gazing time, what happens next week?
Ooh, this should be a poll question.
Perhaps I'm going to ask the co-host for it. Hey, go on, Alex. Go on, Alex.
This one's really hard because the advocate general opinion was actually went more towards the favor of standard contractual clauses. But it's kind of contradictory to the safe harbor ruling made by the court back in 2015. And my experience in the CJEU is that they don't really like to contradict themselves. But it's also very rare for them to give a judgment which is different to the advocate general opinion. So it's a really tough one to predict. I would like to think, and this is the advocate side of me here, so I apologize to all you guys working in the industry who this is going to give a really hard time to, but I would like to think that they're going to invalidate standard contractual clauses and as such probably invalidate safe harbor as the privacy shield as well. Why do I want that to happen? I think because, I mean, for a start, privacy shield was set up as a band-aid, and there are very few differences between privacy shield and safe harbor. And there really hasn't been any significant effort by the US administration, particularly since the current president came into power, to meet the obligations that were required under the privacy shield.
Yeah, that's brilliant, Alex. I mean, I always speak to my clients and I always say that I think clients stop a step too early, in that they often will look at their international data transfers and go, oh, that's great, that's covered by standard contracts clauses. That's great, that's covered by BCRs. That's great, that's covered by, you know, adequacy, whatever. But then I say, well, actually, have you taken the next step, which is what effect does that contract has? You know, you've got an SEC in place with you and your third party, but how has that changed their working practice? How is it actually protecting individuals' privacy at the end of the day? And my fear about international transfers, I think in general, is it just paperwork? Is it just paperwork between two companies signed by lawyers without any change to the, you know, environment that actually safeguards the individuals?
Nobody reads standard contractual clauses or actually really abides by them. Let's be honest.
Well, come on, isn't there an audit trail?
Just the other day.
Wait a minute. Objection, Your Honor. No, you have to read them.
Okay, that wasn't from any personal knowledge. That was just said for controversial purposes. Disclaimer, disclaimer, disclaimer.
I think another reason why I want the judgment to go the way Safe Harbor went is because of the sheer hypocrisy, to be honest. You know, there's a huge amount of rhetoric around China at the moment and data being blocked from going to China. We saw it with Zoom. We've seen it with Huawei and various other TikTok and various other companies at the moment in this political, I don't know, schoolyard argument, it seems almost, between China and the US. And I find it really, truly hypocritical that we know that the US is surveilling. You know, we've known this for a long time. We know that US technologies such as Cisco have backdoors in there for surveillance purposes. It's documented. It's been documented for 20 years. You know, so why is it okay for the US to do these things, but it's not okay for China to do these things or other states to do these things?
Because we're the US.
And I find that hypocrisy when it comes to safeguarding privacy and data protection, that it's okay for us to allow the US to do all these things, but we must make sure that we protect ourselves from everybody else. And I think there needs to be a more level playing field. There needs to be a global consensus that actually surveillance, unless it's targeted, is bad and shouldn't happen. And that's, you know, as an advocate who's been fighting these things for a very long time, and a sociologist as well, I think that's really one of the most important things that will come out of this ruling.
Okay, Alex, you get to keep talking then, because I'm going to ask you, what's your favorite topic?
My favorite topic, I spent 10 years banging my head against the wall and fighting industry. And there's no secret there. People who know me know that I've been very active in the advocacy space and have been very successful in changing law, particularly with regards to e-privacy and data protection. But nowadays, I get a lot more satisfaction out of trying to develop solutions. So when I go into a company and I look at what they're doing, and you know, I've got their marketing guy in tears because I've just told them that everything he's doing is illegal. But then 3 hours later, he's coming up to me with a beer, thanking me for giving him a solution to be able to do what he needs to do in a compliant way. I get a great deal more satisfaction out of that. I'm looking for alternative technologies. So at the moment, we're developing a product based around synthetic data. So using synthetic data as a means to enable and empower smaller companies to still be able to gain valuable insights through machine learning and predictive modeling, but without the burden of GDPR and compliance because the data is synthetic, so it falls out of scope. Or coming up with solutions to privacy by design solutions to CCTV. We did a research project last year with the incidental, to redact the incidental capture of biometric data by IoT devices. So audio data and video capture, which was not specific for the purpose that the device was in place for. So passing foot traffic, for example, for a CCTV camera in the front of a building, to be able to redact the images of those people as a privacy by design perspective before that gets saved up to the cloud. So I think that's really where my joy comes from now. And I said recently, just last week actually, that if I was to win the lottery, European lottery, I would move out of privacy compliance as a consultant and move into privacy tech development and developing new solutions for privacy enhancing solutions for regular day-to-day technologies.
Love it. Reactions.
I like that idea about synthetic data, but I think I'd be interested in your take on the inherent biases that reflect who puts together that synthetic data, because that's kind of a generic and easy sounding term. But as you know, whoever's preparing the data set and for whatever purpose, there's going to be some inherent bias as to who's putting it together. And that may lead to some results that you may not expect, even though you're not using real data.
Yeah,
true. Garbage in, garbage out.
It depends on the methodology that you're using. So the methodology that we use for our technology currently is we take existing real data set, high quality, low volume, and then we use that to train the GAN. And then the GAN spits out the synthetic data out the back of that, which is statistically the same as the data that went in. And that way we can remove the original data set and then use the existing synthetic data output to then train future models. So obviously we have issues when it comes to algorithmic bias. It's a big subject in AI and machine learning currently. I speak about it frequently when I'm speaking for Singularity University on data ethics. And I think in situations where there is a, what's the word I'm trying to pick out here, where there's a motive behind the data, then those biases are far more likely to come through. But in our situation, we have no motive. We're taking data and we're creating more data.
I don't believe that.
As opposed to us having a specific purpose for ourselves, we're looking for the purpose for the client. So the client dictates what the purpose is. We develop a model based around that purpose. And each model is unique to each client. So sure. Yes, there will likely be some issues that we'll have to overcome in the future. There are in all new technologies. But I'm not as concerned about algorithmic bias in the way that we create synthetic data as might be in some other circumstances.
Interesting.
Yeah. Agreed. I love it. So we've only got about 10 minutes left. And so these were all fascinating hot topics. I feel like I should open up a poll and put them in and say, which one do you think is really the hottest topic? But frankly, I think they all are. So I'm not going to make y'all pick between them. Okay, I'll mention my favorite topic since I haven't done that yet. So it's not really an area of privacy. It's more to do with the career of privacy. So the hot thing on my brain right now is that traditionally privacy has been a gender balanced field for whatever reason, however it grew up. The salaries are pretty much equal. It's pretty much balanced men and women, if not outweighed by women. But now I'm starting to see job advertisements that prefer a law degree, even though it may not be a law position. They want a law degree to understand it, which is great since I teach law to law students, teach privacy law to law students. And I think that's because the complexity of the laws that we're now having to work with. They want someone that understands the laws. And we all know that maybe the population going into law school is equal, but once you start getting up into the ranks of experience, you're very heavily weighed males over females. So do you think that's going to have any impact in the industry for one, gender imbalance, or two, pay scale differences that tend to follow an imbalance of gender imbalanced fields?
I think there's a third thing there as well. And I think the third thing is the quality of the performance of the people coming in. Because I think you touched on a really important point there with the requirement of a law degree. Something I've struggled with for over 10 years. I'm not a lawyer, I'm a computer scientist by trade. Yet I've been involved in developing three of the biggest laws in Europe based around privacy and data protection. And I'm a person that lawyers and academic scholars of law come to when they're looking for advice on these particular areas of my expertise. And when I first started lobbying in Brussels over 10 years ago, 12 years ago now, I was often almost ushered out of the room by lawyers who were lobbying on behalf of big companies because they felt I had no right to be there as a non-lawyer. So I think there are a number of issues in this requirement for a law degree that are coming through. Some of them are going to be gender balance, obviously. Hopefully, I don't think payment bias will come in there. I think we're more mature as a society nowadays to offer the same salary to males and females, particularly in this field. I'm very proud of how this particular profession handles that. And as you said, I think currently there's probably more females in this profession than there are males. So hopefully the balance won't come into it.
Yeah, Alex, you touched on something that you're right. I had not mentioned is that now with the demand for data protection officers, and, you know, 2 years ago, the IAPP put out estimates of 75,000 new privacy professionals needed. And then what was it, a year and a half later, over 500,000 DPOs have been, not over 500,000 individual DPOs, but over 500,000 companies have registered DPOs in Europe. So some of those may be some of the same people, but even if we split it in half, that's 250,000. That's a magnitude of what, four? Of what was anticipated. And that's DPOs, not all the other privacy roles that go with it, which means we've got people who know absolutely nothing about privacy, taking a course, getting a certification, not a bad thing. If you have to have a route to do it, that's a good way of doing it. But they have no practical experience whatsoever in privacy.
I think we've all come across this cowboy culture over the past 3 years when it comes to data protection. We all witnessed it. I've heard probably everybody I know who works in privacy complain about the idiot consultants who've gone from one role into privacy because it's the greatest new thing. It was a chance to earn some quick money. And then they've left clients in complete disarray by giving the worst advice possible. And then the professionals have to go in there and clean it up. And at the same time, try and justify their price. Because the guys who went in there in the first place have gone in at you know, maybe 10, 15% of what the actual value of that service is just to get the contract and screwed it up for them. So yeah, it's been a huge problem and I think continues to be so, although not so much now as it was in 2018, 2019.
But I will also say that that same thought process applies to the hundreds and hundreds of privacy tech vendors that are entering the marketplace that also have absolutely no substantive knowledge of privacy. It's some teenager in their garage that created some sort of app to, you know, fix our woes, right?
And you'll see the same thing with the next consumer privacy piece of legislation going through in California this November. We'll see the same thing when e-privacy regulation comes through finally in the EU. There'll be this uptick in non-professionals moving into the space selling snake oil. And I think that's inevitable in any popular thing. We saw it in Y2K back in 99, 98, 99, the same sort of situation. Yes, I'm that old.
Let's all put on a badge. We survived Y2K, right? I was a nurse that night. We thought machines were going to crash. Let's just be honest.
I think it's inevitable, and it's not something that's going to go away in the near future. I think we'll continue to see it as the world of privacy, and particularly from a legislative and regulatory perspective, is ever expanding, with countries all over the world introducing legislation and regulations which are kind of mirrored on GDPR or CCPA. And as that balloon keeps inflating, we're going to see that space filled with more cowboys.
Where does the role of industry come in? I think the industry is somewhat matured because you have some interest groups like the IAPP, you've got the Future Privacy Forum, you've got other private individuals running educational forums. I've seen a lot of educational opportunities, which are really top shelf that give people the background and the skills that they need. And I'll have to admit to all you guys that I'm one of the new urban cowboys here in the privacy field. I've been a lawyer for 23 years, but I've only been involved in privacy, so to speak, for about 6 months, just because it's a topic that started to fascinate me. And it's something that really caught my attention. And I thought that I could have a place to have an impact. And so when I decided that I wanted to get into it, no, I didn't start calling up people and say, hey, can I be your privacy lawyer? instead, I sought out these industry groups and really began to educate myself, taking it slow and easy. So I would be careful with the broad brush that you paint about newcomers to the field, because I don't know anybody that's got 10 years of experience in GDPR, do you? I don't think it's been around that long.
And then,
let's talk about the CCPA or the Brazilian law.
Right.
Everything is just so new. And so what really is necessary is somebody with the adaptable skills to, first of all, educate themselves and become an expert on this. And this is really a moving target, legislatively, technologically, everything. So I think there's plenty of opportunity.
Make a very good point, Tom, yeah.
I wasn't trying to paint with a broad brush. Obviously, there are exceptions to that. You know, people who come into this with the right motivation are a completely different type of person to the people I was referring to. And I'm sure Ralph will agree with me there. He said the same thing. In fact, we've discussed this many times in the past. and as somebody who's a licensed trainer with the IAPP, and I've taught hundreds of people with certifications for IAPP, obviously, I'd love to see new people come into the field who have a passion for it. But there's that segment of the market that came in purely to jump on the bandwagon and make a quick buck and then disappear again as soon as the appropriate comment that I can't make hit the fan. Yeah.
Well, and here's the thing. So Hands Show or II Voices, who knows anyone that is successful in privacy, or I don't know how I'm going to phrase this. Everyone I know that is successful in privacy has a passion for it.
Yeah.
You're not doing it. You're not doing it because it's a living. If you're successful, now there's quite a few unsuccessful ones, but if you're successful, it's because you have a passion for it. I nays, all eyes say I. Okay, that was everybody, just for the record. And the other thing is, and I want to make sure that we end this on a positive note. Bob, I know you were going to say something, so I want to give you that opportunity.
No, I had a quick question because, and maybe you guys are going to pick this up or do another podcast. We're also looking at this confluence, migration, whatever you want to call it, to these chief data officers. Because I think privacy is also becoming much more, not so much about the lawyers as much as it's becoming about data management. And I've been a big advocate about data management, you know, over the last 10, 12 years and saying, yeah, privacy is all well and good. Data protection is all well and good. And if you look at some of the documentation and some of the speeches that have come out of the EU, in particular Article 29 over the years, that's kind of been the focus, which is, you know, how do we start to look at data management holistically? So it's nice to see these sort of chief data officers coming up as well. And I think there's some opportunity. I think there's opportunity there for those with privacy passion to get into that sort of data officer field. So,
well, Bob, I mean, it's just a reason. I mean, again, like Alex, being in this from the late 90s, you know, we had privacy laws here in the UK from 84, you know, remember that? And, you know, actually, the original data protection professionals were librarians, were archivists, were records managers, were people with their fingers in the filing cabinets.
It was the same way here in the US, Ralph. The people that became HIPAA officers or FERPA officers were the records clerks who worked in the offices. So I have to bring this fascinating, and y'all should be proud of me, I only said fascinating once earlier, to this podcast. Thank you very much. Y'all gave me wonderful ideas. So if you like our series, please do tell your friends and colleagues about us. Should you have any questions or suggestions, please reach out to us via SeriousPrivacy@trustark.com or on Twitter @podcastprivacy. You will find Kay on Twitter, that's me, at Heart of Privacy, and then you'll find Paul at EuroPaulB. Thank you again for listening to Serious Privacy. I have to say, I love the way this experiment went. And we can all say goodbye individually until our next episode.
Okay, bye,
y'all.
Bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Goodbye.
Bye.
That was Serious Privacy.
Hey listeners, looking to navigate the realm of responsible AI data privacy governance? Well, look no further.
Absolutely. TrustArc is paving the way, offering a complete approach to managing privacy risks in the world of AI.
TrustArc allows organizations to confidently use AI with personal or sensitive data, moving forward efficiently and cost-effectively.
And here's the kicker. Protect your company and data with TrustArc's privacy-driven compliance software.
Because their deep automation streamlines data privacy governance, cutting your time to compliance with automated data mapping, risk assessments, and regulatory reporting.
TrustArc's enhancements go way beyond that, helping organizations understand AI better and align cross-functionally on data governance, privacy, and security.
Plus, they provide guidance on privacy governance for AI and how to mitigate risks using frameworks like NIST AI, OECD AI, and the NIMACY Privacy Management Accountability Framework.
If you're aiming for compliance excellence, check out Privacy Central, seriously one of my best parts. It uses automation and privacy expertise to understand your requirements, build and manage your privacy program with ease.
Oh, I agree. Privacy Central is your go-to to measure your progress toward responsible AI data compliance.
Stay ahead with TrustArc's Privacy Central. Visit TrustArc.com now. Ask me and Paul if you have any questions.